I have a conviction that the brain is understandable. You look inside these AI models, and there's like some clarity coming up, but it's also super confusing. So I believe that there's a huge landscape of different architectures that are able to solve these tasks. And we have two points. There's ChatGPT and DALL-E, and there's like the brain. And I think the brain is on one extreme of efficiency and understandability.
Right.
And that's what I want. Right. That's what I care about.
I'm John Fox, director of the Del Monte Institute for Neuroscience here at the University of Rochester. And I'd like to welcome you to another episode of Neuroscience Perspectives. I'm absolutely thrilled to be joined by renowned neuroscientist, Professor Doris Tsao. Her pioneering research has transformed our understanding of how the brain processes visual information. And her lab helped us discover that it takes only a few hundred neurons to encode any given face. For reference, as many of you will know, there are billions of neurons in the brain. Dr. Tsao is a professor of neurobiology at University of California, Berkeley, and she's been the recipient of numerous awards, including most recently the Kavli Prize, one of the most prestigious international science prizes there is. She's also been elected as a very young scientist to the National Academy of Sciences and was named an investigator of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, which is among the highest of distinctions for biomedical research. Doris, thank you so much for joining us here on Neuroscience Perspective. I'm dying to get into things with you and ask you a bunch of questions about yourself. But let's kick off with your research. Why faces? Why the visual system? Where did that all come from?
I knew I wanted to study the visual system since probably high school, when I realized that the visual system, the neurons, are what generates our perception of everything. Yeah. But I came to faces kind of by accident. I was a graduate student. I was recording in V1. I was initially interested in this question of how the brain represents space. And I wasn't getting anywhere, so I got into fMRI. Yeah. And I read about Nancy Kanwisher's work that reported a face area in the human brain. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed like a fun thing to do. Let's just show faces and objects to a monkey and see if monkeys also might have a face area.
Yeah.
And
then you found they didn't just have one face area. They had a whole system of face areas.
Yes,
right?
Yes. And so it took off on its own. Every question kind of naturally led to the next questions. Like, yeah, so if there's six face areas, what are they each doing? Are they each doing something different?
Yeah. Tell us about these six face areas. Why six in a monkey for faces?
We wondered about that for a long time. And a few years ago, I think we discovered the answer. Basically, there's a whole map of object space. So object space, same way we have 3D space, we can represent, different points and locations. So this part of the brain called IT cortex represents objects also in this more abstract space that's also two-dimensional, and there's repeated copies of it, and the representation becomes more and more invariant, and so you have these multiple stages, and that's why you have these multiple copies of this map, and faces are one part of that map, and so when you just look at faces, you see these six face patches.
I gotcha. Okay, so it's six levels of complexity, is that a way to think about it?
I think
But highly, they're part of a circuit, right? So they're interacting to evolve, and eventually then, an individual face. I think we all remember these stories about like the Jennifer Aniston neuron and that.
Yeah.
When you get down to the level of like dissociating two very similar faces from your life, the representation there is actually very limited in terms of the number of neurons that are involved. Is that fair to say, or is that not the right way to think about it?
Yeah, so face carries so much information. There's the information about the physical features, there's information about the identity, the expression, and I should say this is still, we're still figuring all this out,
sure,
right? It's still early days, but indeed, you don't need that many cells to represent the identity, which is kind of surprising. You look at a face, it just, it feels so complex, right?
Yeah,
it's
yeah,
like ineffable,
yeah.
Like who knows how many neurons that would take. But it turns out that with just 50 numbers, and this is something that computer vision people discovered, with like 50 numbers, you can like recreate the face, right? So you can really compress the information down.
Yeah.
And it turns out that the neurons use a code that is very similar to one that the computer vision people figured out for how to compress the information.
Gotcha, yeah. So this sort of dimensionality reduction
yeah.
is instantiated neurons in much the way, same way that one can do it with a formula in silico in a computer.
Exactly. And, you know, in recent years, like with DALL-E, right, where you can, like, you know, specify any prompt and it can create a picture of anything that you can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
That idea of being able to compress reality has really taken off, right? Yeah, and they're kind of an existence proof that, you know, like the space of all possible, for example, 500 by 500, you know, RGB images. It's like, it's more than the number of atoms, you know, in the universe, right?
Goodness, yeah.
But, you know, with just this like 1 gigabyte, you know, neural network, like you can create any, like, yeah. any picture of reality. And the reason is because reality is much lower dimensional than the space of all possible images, right? So much of that space is just like random noise,
yeah,
right? But then
yeah.
there's like... Yeah,
the space of reality, of objects,
and there's like
yeah.
beautiful ways to discover those spaces that these machine learning people
right.
are figuring out. And obviously the brain has figured out how to do that with
right.
its limited neurons. And so that's what we're trying to figure out.
You know, and it's all the buzz is about AI at the moment. And you made a case yesterday, and I'd be interested to hear you sort of extrapolate on that a bit. You know, that actually it's still very important for us to understand the neurobiology of vision, because we have a lot of insights of how that's achieved to provide to AI folks, and that there's still a place for neuroscience in the face
yeah.
of AI.
I mean, it is incredible. You know, our brain runs on 30 watts while you hear about them, like OpenAI building nuclear reactor farms to power, you know, next generation of ChatGPT. So I think the brain is so much more efficient.
Yeah.
I have a conviction that the brain is understandable. And, you know, it's you look inside these AI models, and it, you know, there's like some clarity coming up, but it's also super confusing. So I believe that there's, you know, a huge landscape of different architectures that are able to solve these tasks. And we have two points. You know, there's ChatGPT and DALL-E, and there's like the brain. And I think the brain is on one extreme of efficiency and understandability.
Right, right.
And that's what I want.
Right,
that's
these AIs are built on the part that you can take brute force, super fast computers, and a lot of energy and just churn through billions of calculations.
Exactly. And they just impose this one arbitrary architecture. You know, what is the likelihood that that is the architecture, right? Like, I just really believe that the evolution figured out some tricks that we can still learn from.
Here's a thought. I was thinking about technologies and the way in which you sort of have pulled together multiple technologies to address your question. And we're sort of living in this like extraordinary time, right? Particularly over the last couple of decades, as you've sort of built out your career, where, you know, fMRI came online, high field magnets, extraordinary electrophysiological techniques. How much is that driving? And do you see AI, for example, now interfacing with that and really driving forward science in a whole new way?
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I'm sure you know this quote from Sidney Brenner, right? Like progress in science is driven by new tools, new phenomena, and new ideas in that order of importance. And
that's
that sadly is true. And I was just so lucky, you know, when I was in Boston as a grad student to land at Mass General Hospital, where there were all these experts on fMRI, you know, the Martinos Imaging Center. And that was like so important, right? Because these face patches, like just sticking an electrode into the temporal lobe, you would never find them. Or you might, but you couldn't then find it again.
Yeah.
Whereas this was like, you know, it just gives you a systematic way, right?
Yeah.
fMRI gives you this bird's eye view of the brain, so you can see all the, you know, loci that are important, then you can go in and study the single neurons in detail. So
right. Around those same time, people like Greg McCarthy and Ina Puce, Truett Allison, were using ECOG and seeing face fusiform face area.
Yes, they were the pioneers, that really suggested there was something
there's something special going off down there.
Down
it's
there,
amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, having done some of those recordings myself, you know, when you have an electrode sitting over the fusiform face area and you show it a face, I mean, it announces itself. Like, it's really, it's really amazing.
Good. So we share that.
yeah. So when did you decide you wanted to be a scientist, or you think this is where I'm going to end up?
You know, I wasn't interested in science very much as a kid. I was not really a curious child. I played with Barbie dolls.
Really? Yeah.
I love to read. And so, I always found the stories, the biographies of scientists very inspiring. These were people who came from humble backgrounds, but just by working hard, they could, you know, achieve glory. So, so that seemed like a very accessible path to glory to me. And then it was after I got accepted to Caltech, and, you know, I was worried I was going to fall behind. And so my senior year, I started reading the Feynman Lectures on Physics, Volume 1. And that was when I understood what science was about. It was so beautiful. Yeah. It's like being, it's just like this freedom to ask any question you want and use your brain and think through it logically and come to an insight.
Yeah, yeah. Those Feynman Lectures, you can get them on YouTube, and he has this fantastic Brooklyn accent, and
they're really
wonderful. He's such an entertainer.
Yes.
Totally recommend them to people. You don't need to be a physicist to enjoy Richard Feynman telling his stories. Yeah, amazing. So now, but your mom and dad were academics?
Yeah, we came to the U.S. so that they were graduate students at the University of Maryland. My mom was a computer programmer.
Right.
I wouldn't call her an academic.
I think
she was my mom. but my dad, you know, he was during the Cultural Revolution, he was sent off to Manchuria to like chop trees. And he always knew that that period would end and there would be a new day. And so he, you know, brought a thick stack of math books with him, like studying functional analysis in the forest. And so, you know, after the end of the Cultural Revolution, he got into Peking University and then we came to the US. And so, he's a mathematician and always like just deeply curious.
Right.
You know, he's 82 years old now. He works harder than I do. Like whenever I go in his room, he's like watching a YouTube video, like learning a new. Recently, he got excited about this area of math I've never heard of called sheaf theory. And it's like, apparently it's about how you can, everything is defined by its relation to other things, and he's telling me how that's like the essence of Marxism, and so that's the kind of person he is. Yeah.
so mathematics to political theory.
He's just a
brilliant mind.
Yes.
And an inspiration then to you both the practical part of computer science that your mom brings to the table and the inspirational.
Yes.
Creativity.
You know, my mom actually like programmed some stimuli for me when I was studying these spaces.
Yeah. So a big move, though, to come from China to the U.S. in the 80s, was it?
Yeah, 1980.
Moved to the U.S. Yeah. And how much of that do you remember? You must have been extraordinarily young at that point.
I remember this night we were in Hong Kong. I remember tasting chocolate for the first time on that journey.
Goodness.
Somehow. The U.S. You know, when we first came, my grandfather, he had been here for many years, and so he would have these, like American culture evenings, apparently. Like he would teach, like, because I came with my cousins and their family, and so he would teach them about like all the American traditions. Like this is football, and here's the rules and stuff. Yeah.
Wow. And were you 5 or 6 or something?
I was four.
You were four, mm-hmm. Right? So and yet very profound memories of that, obviously, because it was such a big change.
Mm-hmm.
And how much of your very early childhood in China do you remember?
Vague glimmerings.
And then you studied mathematics though in university, right? As well.
Yeah,
so
I studied math and biology.
I
really love math. Yeah, I wish I could if I had a secret wish, it'd be like if I could go do a math PhD. Yeah.
Look at that. Well, maybe you will. Like your dad at 82.
Yeah.
That's outstanding. Yeah. Now, so then you went to Caltech. You did your undergraduate there, and then you went to Harvard for graduate school. And then you ended up in a very important lab, or a very famous lab, right, with Marge Livingston. Tell us a little bit about that and the impact Marge had on you.
Marge is an incredible scientist. She's such a true scientist. You know, the first time I met her, like during the graduate school interviews, she was recording, and she kind of like had to finish her experiment. And then she looked up at me and said, hello. And then she was like, so just direct, you know, she said, what are you interested in? I told her something vague about, you know, I want to understand neural circuits. And she said, well, if I were interested in neural circuits, I would go to Larry Katz's lab.
Really?
And I thought maybe this is not going so well. But, you know, she just like intuitively understood me. You know, I was very shy. I remember I was like, Marge, can I talk to you about something? You know, because I wanted to join her lab and I didn't have to say anything more. She said, I ordered an amplifier for you already. Yes.
Wow.
it was wonderful. Yeah. She just, you know, does her own experiments every day. And she like taught us by example.
Yeah, true. I mean, my God, like one of the great leading fission scientists in history.
Yes, incredible. You know, she started as a Drosophila neuroscientist, discovered these, you know, learning mutants.
Fruit flies,
right?
Yeah.
And then she went on to, she became so interested in vision, like she felt like she found her calling. And And she's also done incredible work, like understanding the relationship between art and vision, how artists.
And so her mentorship style, like she's, you know, sleeves rolled up in the lab making recordings. And have you taken that into your own lab? Is that how do you approach
not
it?
Not as much as Marge. I don't know how. I think I'd like to. I do try, but
sure,
there's just time management.
That's an amazing trajectory. And then you did something a little strange too, because you know most people, you know, the American science engine. But you took off for Germany, right? And went to Bremen?
Bremen, yeah.
Yeah. And what was the, like, why? What was the decision there and how did that work?
I got a fellowship from the Humboldt Foundation to set up my own little lab. This was, you know, I got my PhD and I spent two more years in Marge's lab. But then, it was like an amazing opportunity.
So you didn't do a, you know, official postdoc?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, we had found these face patches and it just, like, there's so many questions.
And
so
that
was
yeah.
like an amazing opportunity to keep studying this on my own.
Yeah.
So
you're off to Germany.
Mm-hmm. And I'd always been interested in German culture.
You were? Okay. Well, where does that come from?
I think it started with music. Like my father, he was always listening to Beethoven. And
I see.
I think that's where it started.
Yeah, yeah. And was that culture shock? Was it different? Or did you settle easily?
I loved Germany. It was like a much simpler place. You know, Bremen's a small town. There's like one department store, Karstadt. Yeah. So there wasn't much to do. So I found a violin teacher. I fell in love with the violin again. I loved it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's a brave move. I mean, to get out of your PhD and your own milieu and the place that you've sort of trained and to take off for Europe to a foreign country to launch a science career. I mean, and are there lessons in that, for example, for your trainees? Is there something about that streak in you that's willing to take a chance that's part of how you approach science?
I mean, every path is unique, but I think, I've never worried too much about, I've just never worried too much, like about the future. I've always had this like irrational exuberance. And so I try to like tell my trainees, just like follow your heart, what you want to do. Everything else will take care of itself.
Yeah, yeah. You gave a wonderful talk yesterday, and I was really appreciated the part where you made sure to point out exactly who the folks were that did the work, the graduate students and the postdocs, and give credit where credit's due. And it's obvious that you've put some very, very talented people through your lab.
Oh, yeah. Everything is due to them. They're just, it is such a privilege to be able to work with these brilliant young people.
Right. It begins and ends with that sort of vibrancy in the ranks, you know, and training people. There's nothing better, right?
There's nothing better than to like be slacking furiously about a new idea with a student and fantasizing, and it doesn't get better than that.
I love it. Here, I read a quote, just going back to mentorship, and you know, we were talking about some of these leading elders in the field, you know, and you this is a quote, I love this. It said, "All of us desire to find a mentor who sees us as we wish to be rather than as we are." That's quite profound. Could you unpack that for us? What drove that thought?
That was about Marge.
Yeah.
My PhD advisor. She I felt that's how she treated me. Like I was like a child, not her, like, you know, oarswoman for her grant.
Right. The engine room, right?
She like even when I was a young faculty member, like, you know, Caltech was starting out, and I said something about it. I was like still studying math, and she sent me an email and she was like, you know, you should keep doing that. I believe you can do something great, you know, in that realm. And it's like she's always encouraged me, like this side of me that's not like maybe conventional. I don't know. It's very
and
important.
Maybe is it fair to say then, you know, there's a pragmatics part of mentorship in a PhD. Mm-hmm. You need to learn this material. You need to know how to do this technique. You need to be able to.
Yeah.
And then there's the humano-centric piece of it. There's the development of the individual through these, you know, early 20s into a fully formed human. And that a real mentorship sees those two things equally.
Yes. Like, I think that, like, you know, everyone in our field comes in with this like ambition, right? This raw ambition, and like you have to nurture that. Like, and I think like somehow, you know, like on the outside, I think it was like this like soup crazy shy, you know, girl, like disheveled hair and all that. And it was like, but Marge like saw this like, you know, this like inner flame, and she like nurtured that. And I hope I do that for my trainees, because they have their wild dreams, and I think that's so important, right?
Developing the human as well. The shyness. Tell me about the shyness. Is it gone, or is it still there?
It's totally still there. Yeah. You know, and I like.
But you've learned to.
I've learned
conquer
to cope with it. Like we're talking right now somehow. Like.
Well, but I've seen you giving talks so many times, and you're a very confident presenter. And I think if somebody just saw the talk, they wouldn't know the shy Doris.
Oh yeah, no. When I go to a conference, like there's always like this moment when in the hotel lobby, I see all these colleagues, and I just like feel this dread. Oh my God. Like,
I think even the most extroverted people get that.
Like, oh, really? Oh,
I do, yeah. And then,
really?
Yeah, no, I do. I think that's true. Oh, I certainly do, yeah. I was a very, very shy youngster. I sometimes say that to people and they're like, no, that's ridiculous. But it was, you know. I must say, I often have that, like, you know, you walk into the reception at one of those meetings and I go, oh gosh. What if I'm just standing there alone as well? Just like, you know, you wade in, I suppose. Yeah. So you've had to conquer that as part of it. Because obviously the other piece is, you know, there's the doing the science, but the communicating part is equally important, right?
Yeah, yeah. I have to, again, you know, thank my mentors for that, like teaching me how to give talks and so on.
Yeah. You know, we're living in strange political times for science, and they sort of, you know, the public perception of science as you know, there was a time, I think I read recently, you know, if you go back 10, 15 years, public trust in scientists was in the high 90%. You know, 98% of people had complete trust in the system. I think those numbers would not be there today. What are we doing wrong, and how do we get at that? How do we get at science communication that brings our public along with us? Do you have thoughts around that?
Yes. I think we need to tell people about our science, make many more efforts to do that. And I think this podcast is a great way to do that.
Wow.
I myself am like writing a book now, trying to link neuroscience, philosophy, and self-help, you know, because there's this whole genre of like neuroscience-based self-help that's around like how you can sleep better, how you can eat better, and so on.
Yeah.
But I'm interested, I believe that the mind-body problem, insights into consciousness, into free will, like those insights don't live in some pure realm, right? They're about the brain, and the brain is what we use to behave with, and they have like profound implications for how we should live our life, and I want to work that out. And
So you're waiting solidly into this space to bring neuroscience.
I hope then to, you know, go out into like the Oakland Unified School District, where, you know, there are many underrepresented students who may not be thinking about careers in neuroscience, but they do care about, you know, how should I live my day tomorrow? Like, do I have free will? I think they would be totally captivated by that question if they could like discover that there's a link between that and electrical activity in the brain. You know, maybe they will change. That'll change their career trajectory.
Outstanding. Thank you so much. Thanks so much for spending some time with us and allowing us to get to know you a little bit better, Doris. You're a major star in the field. Look forward to watching you in the decades ahead and see how the work evolves.
Thank you so much. This was fun.